Thanks for listening to season 4 of the Utah Real Estate Podcast.
The most downloaded series in the whole state and possibly the world.
Hello, I'm Steph Scholl here with the one and only Silver Dollar Man.
Also known as Scott Stevenson. This year, we are consulting with community leaders about the future of the Beehive State.
And how you can best secure a house for your home.
Join the thousands.
And my mom.
That subscribe every Thursday for the most exciting hour of the week.
Scott, so have you ever seen a tiny house?
Maybe, because my first house was pretty tiny. It was only 1,000 square feet.
That's not exactly what I'm talking about. Good thing we have Adam Breen with Breen Homes. He's here to tell us why tiny house living is all the rage right now.
Well, we had Adam on for the Parade of Homes series, and we heard that he did tiny homes. So we're excited to have him back. So tell me, Adam, what's the difference between a tiny house that I lived in and a tiny house that you build?
God, it's relative, right? Because yeah. You're right. I mean, to some people would say 1,000 square feet is a tiny home. I feel like I live in 3,000 square feet, and sometimes I feel like that's tiny. Now with kids running around and my wife around, it feels tiny. I really live in 15 square feet of my house. Like my only private space is my bed. And really, it's not even my bed. It's just the side of the bed that I sleep on. So my tiny home is like 15 square feet, and I live there perfectly happy. I get to share everything with everybody else. It's interesting. If you start talking, what is a tiny home? It's hard to justify the category that fits in. I might say under 400 square feet, maybe even down below to 300 square foot range, but is a full livable home with all the amenities that a home would need to live in. We could toss in there of, is it movable? Can you put it on a trailer, drag it somewhere? Is it on wheels? Is it more mobile? There's a lot of things that you can start to classify when we talk tiny homes, so to speak. And there's a huge range of it. I mean, tiny homes go from hobbyists that are building them in their backyard for their own hobby, up to people that are truly living in their 150 square foot mobile home that they're driving across the country. I mean, look at Sprinter vans.
Yeah. It's
a tiny home. Yeah. And those are what, maybe 60 square feet? two people live in those day in and day out. You go to the rock climbing community, half of them live in those things. Yeah, I don't think there's a good definition for what a tiny home is.
What do you think most people think that is? I mean, when you hear the word a tiny home,
I would say that most people dive right into what we currently call in the industry is an ADU, an accessory dwelling unit. So something that could be placed in a yard, on a small cabin lot, that is truly built off-site or even a hobbyist built on-site and moved into a position that would be small living. So you live in your front room, kitchen, bedroom, bathroom, and every space is flexed into as compressed as you could possibly get it.
So is that what it is, an ADU?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. There you go. Maybe I should have defined that a little bit better. Huh? An ADU is considered an accessory dwelling unit from a city standpoint. That's how they look at them. What that really means is accessory to a primary structure. A primary structure may be your home. An accessory dwelling unit would be a live-in-able rental type or mother-in-law type building that you would put either attached or detached to your primary unit. If I were to cast this umbrella or this net of like tiny home living, who does that entail? And it really goes from truly down to the hobbyist of somebody that's living in their Sprinter van or dragging almost like a fifth wheel trailer around the country because they don't want to set roots in one spot, you know, down to somebody that may be living off the grid and wants to live as minimal as they can. But look at apartments nowadays. I mean, how many times have you seen an apartment that's 500 square feet or under? Mm-hmm. And we're starting to see homes that small just to create affordability for people to live. And I think a lot of the push of coming from a home builder and developer background, a lot of the push is not the hobbyist style. I tend to rule the hobbyist out and say, whether you're living in it to rock climb and you want to live out of a van, or you want to have a paint studio in your backyard, let's put the hobbyist in a category and kind of push that off to the side. Mm-hmm. And let's really talk about the affordability component and why people are choosing to live in tighter spaces. It's because they can't afford to go out and traditionally buy a 1,500 to 3,500 square foot home on a quarter or a third of an acre. So we're all looking at ways to compress down so we can afford to live in the communities we want to be in. And I think that's really the definition of a tiny home that I probably know more about, more familiar with the challenges and the cons and pros of what that is.
Is there a zone? Are there zoning issues with tiny homes?
Absolutely, yeah.
How is the Salt Lake area or Utah in regards to that? Are they friendly towards that or no?
That's a mixed bag of questions for sure. Yeah. I think on paper, they're friendly to it. Most municipalities or cities have at this point forced from a state or a federal level to have to allow ADUs. It was a affordability component that the state brought in, I'd say a couple of years ago, saying every city needs to have an affordable housing component or a way to deal with irate prices going up. And one of the ways was saying you have to allow ADUs, accessory dwelling units, in your municipality. So most every city wrote an ADU clause saying, we allow them, you can put them in. When it came down to the restrictions of what they wrote, if you start reading between the lines, most of those cities were saying, we really don't want to allow them. We're going to make it very difficult to allow them. When that first came out, that's when I started to venture down and it was even a little prior to that when I started venturing down the world of building tiny homes. And we can get into that a little bit later. But as I got into that, I had hundreds of people calling me, we want an ADU. Can you deliver an ADU? What is it going to cost to build it? And everyone, we put out a price. At the time, we were building them in factory for about $65,000, about a 350,000 square foot unit that we could ship to the site and have delivered. And then it was, how do we get over this hill of permits, fees, connections? And right there would stop almost any consumer from buying one. Of, wait, I got to go get a city permit. I've got to pay how much for those permits and fees? What are my taxes on that? How do I have to connect it? The type of parking that I have to put out in front of it, the access that I have to, it became very difficult for any individual to say, I want an additional component of rental on my property. So yeah. I think to answer your question, they're friendly to saying, yes, we will allow them, but then they wrote restrictions hard enough to make it really tough to allow them.
Yeah, because I don't know that I've seen on many properties, and maybe I just haven't looked at hard enough. I haven't seen that many tiny homes on what I would classify as an ADU.
Yeah.
In the backyard of somebody's house, there's a tiny house. I'm not even sure I've seen one.
What's become, yes, there are, but very few. What's become more popular is what they call attached ADUs. So a more common term is like a mother-in-law apartment in the basement above a garage, but something that's attached to the unit that you're able to legally separate and then legally rent out. Now, this world gets confusing because you go, Airbnb, we've been renting out our basements, a bedroom for 10, 20 years, right? That's been against the law from a city's perspective. People have illegally rented their homes for 30, 40, 50 years. It always was common of, we'll have an additional kitchen for our mother-in-law, but we can rent it out and produce income. But people have done that on an individual basis. And that's against zoning codes in most cities would not allow that in their ordinance. So then as we came out with this allowing ADUs, it was allowed to put a attached ADU, which is really just separating a portion of your house and saying this is its own apartment and I can legally rent it out. But again, back to your point, that's probably why you're not seeing them, because that's become more popular and it's a little bit easier for the average homeowner to go get the approval from the city and the permit to create that ADU. It's definitely more difficult to do a detached ADU, which is something in the backyard.
Yeah.
Something you'd see there.
Is it legal though? I mean, there are a ton of people I know that have rented out their basement, that have kitchen facilities, et cetera, typically mother-in-law apartment. But are the zoning laws allowing that now?
Yes
and no. Or are people just doing it?
Yeah, the majority of them are people just doing it. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that was the issue of Airbnb. I mean, most Airbnbs, to a degree, are illegal. And maybe I'm blanket statementing that. I don't want to scare anybody away from it. But most of the time it is. Cities just gave up on controlling it because how in the world do you control it? You send some policeman or code enforcer around to every single home that knocks the door and says, wait, who's living here? Are they a family member? Can they be living here? Are you charging rent? So what they did is they now have an ordinance that says, yes, you can legally do it, but you've got to go through the right steps and processes to get there. And every city's a little bit different, but most of them want to know that you're running it under a business license, that you've had a fire marshal approve the access, the ingress and egress to it. You have the parking spaces for it. The reason they want it under a business license is so that you're paying taxes on that and they can monitor it, that kind of stuff. And then a lot of them like the parking is to try to relieve that we're not parking hundreds of cars on the street and blocking up streets. And they want to know that they're actually on the property. Just talk mail delivery. That kind of stuff becomes an issue when you start packing more people under one roof. But yeah, there are legal ways to do it, but I would say the majority of people would quote unquote be illegally renting their basement, their mother-in-law apartment. Which sounds crazy, right? Because we've been doing it forever. It's like, why not? But I don't know. It becomes one of those gray areas. There's nothing wrong with that. I don't care. Be a good neighbor to each other. But the reality is, even from a tax perspective, if you're renting out your basement and they're just writing you a check and you're just taking that as income, You're not paying any taxes on that. Technically, you should be running that under a business. So yeah, there's some things that the city tries to address, you know, which if we go back to the tiny home concept, my focus 5 years ago when I really got into this was offsite construction, building a separate unit that can be shipped and craned onto a job site or a home or a property that becomes a separate ADU or a tiny home living. We spent a lot of time talking to the hobbyists that just wanted to be off the grid and have a cabin property. I don't want to build a 5,000 square foot cabin. I just need enough to go camping, whether it's camping for a weekend, they want a roof overhead for hunting, they want a doomsday prep and just want to be off site mm-hmm. and be self-sufficient. So we got a lot of those hobbyists that came in and often found a struggle with, can we get it approved through the city? How do we connect utilities? Is somebody willing to spend that money from my, let's say it like a remote perspective. Mm-hmm. And then you come back to the inner city urban perspective of, I can't just crane what's a tiny home, but it's still a home, into someone's backyard without making a big splash and the whole neighborhood seeing it. Mm-hmm. And now the city's involved. So I've got to go through approvals at the city. And most of the time when I go back to a client and say, okay, we've done an analysis on your lot. You have enough room in your backyard. We can put it here. We're under the height requirement. We can make this work. But we've got to get a separate business. You got to get that approved through the city. You've got to pay taxes on it. You got to have the parking. You got to connect your utilities. They got to be on the same meter as your current house. And their costs start to drive up. It's crazy. I had one, we did a study. This was probably 3 or 4 years ago in, I'd say, the Sugar House area. The unit we were looking at selling to the client was about $68,000 that was built, finished, and shipped to the property. His utility connections added on about another $20,000 at the time. So still not wild. Look at it and go, okay, I'm sitting at around $80,000 to get this unit here and done, maybe $90,000. Permits and fees alone were $27,000. A third of the cost.
Yeah.
And what they really were, fees. The city saying, we don't want it here. So we're going to charge you $10,000 in park and rec and $5,000 in the education system. It was crazy. Again, we've gotten really long-winded on this. But yeah, I still to this day don't believe that cities really want the option of detached ADUs in backyards. I think they're fighting that. If I really look at where we're going further and further away from affordability, will the recession, or let's whatever we're calling it, will the recession actually cause some help on that? Maybe, but coming from the construction background, we don't see a whole lot of relief yet in labor and material costs. And we know materials are still hard to get a hold of. So is that really going to change? So we know affordability is going to continue to be an issue long term. What are we doing to allow more density? Density is the big bad word, but what are we doing to allow more density in our communities? And does that mean that eventually we'll be renting out, maybe creating a mother-in-law apartment in our own garages and renting out our garages, basements, mm-hmm. bonus spaces above garages, something like that? It's already happening. Why aren't we being more friendly to that?
Well, and it's interesting because I had a friend that was renting her place and she was like, I am getting, and it was a small little room that mm-hmm. she was renting. And she got more couples wanting to be there. And she's like, no, I can't have an extra person. This is a really small place. Yeah. But I think people are struggling to find affordable even rent nowadays. Yeah. And so they are cramming into these small places.
Yeah. There's some unique things that if we're talking a big picture of what I like about tiny homes, I don't live the life that I could live in a tiny home. When I see them, believe it or not, when I've toured some of the units that we've built, I've been very, maybe say, to appealed to, I could live in something like this. Mm-hmm. This is awesome. Get rid of all my extra crap, mm-hmm. all the storage, the 5 Christmas trees, the wreath that we don't need, throw it all away. We're just going to live in a tiny home. The thought of that is awesome to me. The reality is that would never happen with my lifestyle. But I'm also I call us the gap generation. We've talked a little bit about that before with me. I'm of the generation to where we just have stuff. We have keepsakes and more mm-hmm. crap, so to speak. Yeah. A lot of these younger generations don't want all that stuff. Mm-hmm. They can't afford all that stuff. They really care about like their little bit of life and hobby that they have, and that's all they want. And so they are inclined to live out of a car. And how many college kids do you know currently living out of cars? There's a ton of them. Whether it's a Sprinter van or a car, they're living out. They're living. Couch surfing is a big mm-hmm. thing for kids. So one of the things I really love about the concept of an ADU is that if you were to purchase that and it's mobile, you could move it at any point in time. So you could buy an asset mm-hmm. that sits on a piece of property. And really, if you're talking a tiny home, you don't need an eighth of an acre or a quarter of an acre to put a house on. You could start to condense those a little bit more. And then if you ever decide to go move, you could move that car, that vehicle, that tiny home with you. You know, so now all of a sudden you have an asset that you could pick up and say, you know what, we now have made enough money. We've stepped up in the world. We're going to move into a single family home that's attached to a piece of property. And we're going to detach our ADU and put it on a cabin property or leave it as an investment and rent that out or take it down south and put it on a piece of property we own down there that we want to buy or a piece of property we leased. Like, it does have the ability to own something and be able to move it as well.
So I have a question. What's the difference between RV then and a tiny house?
Yeah, good question. Mobile homes, which would fall into RV, is a thing we're all very familiar with. Mobile home parks where you have a separate title. And technically, it's not attached to the property. You lease the property you're on, right? So an attached ADU or a detached ADU that we may be talking is a single family home. By a city's definition, it has to be attached to the property. That doesn't mean it couldn't be moved, but traditionally, I've got to attach utilities to it, and I've got to attach it via foundation or pier and beam to a piece of property. Separation of a mobile home or an RV would be something that has an axle and wheels on it. So most mobile homes, they put that skirt around the base of it that still has an axle and wheels on it. So then technically you're two separate titles. You're a vehicle title and a lease within land. So the idea of combining these together by saying we attached it to the property and now we're connected to utilities, you're now an attached structure, a home on a piece of property that you can then own the property, own the home. No, but that doesn't mean you couldn't pick it up and move it, so to speak.
I mean, I've only seen from tiny homes on the show that they have on Netflix or whatever. But, oh, you turn this cupboard and it's something else. I'm like, it looks like it's a lot of money to build those. So the type of tiny homes that you guys do, grab them for us.
Yeah, for sure. So a tiny home, traditionally we had one in a parade of homes, a Salt Lake parade. It's probably been 3 years. I'm guessing 2 or 3 years since we last had it in there. That home was 30 feet long, 12 feet wide. So 360 square feet. It was a one bedroom, one bath home. The bedroom, if I had to guess off the top of my head, it was 12 feet long and maybe 10 feet wide. So about 120 square feet used in that bedroom. The separate bathroom was a traditional bathroom. So a 5x8. The kitchen was a hallway kitchen. Between where the bedroom and the bathroom set, it left a little traditional space for the kitchen. So that probably made it, I'd say, 7 feet wide by 10 feet long. And then the family room set on the front end of that. And the family room was probably about the same size as the bedroom. So another 12 by 10-ish square feet. So really had a full functioning house compressed down. Now, where do you start to lose your space? You don't have your coat closet. You don't have your walk-in pantry, you don't have your walk-in shower. But as you really start to look at some of those spaces, there was, we had shed roofed the ceiling. So we had a vault that ran up to about 11 feet high on one end, dropped down to 8 feet on the other and just a single shed plane. And then the bathroom was on the tall side of the roof, but built at an 8 foot tall height. So then I had storage above that as well. So technically you could pack stuff on top of the roof of the bathroom inside the structure. So for me, you can compact all that in. One thing I've noticed with people that aren't using the tiny homes as an ADU, maybe they're living in them, traditionally want some outdoor space so they can expand into an outdoor patio deck or a space that they can go out and be outside a little bit more. Because really the house is used for sleeping, cooking, eating, going to the bathroom, showering, and then you should be outside, right? That's the appeal of it. I don't think a lot of people are homebodies that are living in this tiny home, you know. But if you go back to your traditional home, I mean, how much square footage do you really live in? Have you really had to think through, you live in your bathroom, your bedroom, and your kitchen, and maybe your family room. Your family room need to be 24 by 25? Really, if it just has a small love seat for two people to sit on and a TV, I think of a cozy cabin, you could really shrink that down. So does that kind of answer your question of what it looked like?
Yeah.
You know, I almost need to put a picture up for you to show.
No, but like the vaulted ceilings, because I was thinking, I was like, what if you're really tall or whatever? But that gives the feeling of that it's bigger. And is it hard this is my other question. Is it hard to get a loan for these?
They have
to do cash.
Yes and no. Okay. So again, going back to your question of, is it a mobile home? Is it something that moves versus is it attached? If you were to try to get a loan from me today to say, I want to buy one in the factory and have it moved to my property, you're not going to get a loan on it. Once it's set on the property and attached to the property, you can go get a traditional loan on it. So there is a little bit of a difference of when and where are you buying and how are you buying and where are you putting it, then would allow you to get a loan on it. Most people that are buying this type of tiny home is buying it for an accessory, an ADU,
yeah,
a mother-in-law apartment, a hobby shop, like we talked about, the one-off remote lots into a cabin. Mm-hmm. Most people are paying cash for it or pulling a HELOC against the mm-hmm. property that they're currently in and using that for it. But yeah, traditionally you can get loans on them. I've had this dream for years of like, why not create a tiny home community that's on a half acre that you could fit 8, 9, 10 homes on and create a nice little community yeah. outdoor space,
in fact,
attach them and shell off. I mean, why not sell these 2,000 square foot lots? Chop it down. I mean, you can't afford $600,000-$800,000 third acre in Cottonwood Heights, but could you afford 2,000 square feet and then put a tiny home on it and live in a nice little community that had it around? Immediately people's minds go to a mobile home community, but they don't yeah. have to look that way. I mean, some of these tiny homes, you can make them look really cool. We've recently done some, if you think of a rectangle shape that's 12 feet wide, 30 feet long, you could take one whole wall and turn it into sliding glass opening doors that go to the outside. So you could create a really cool open concept. And if I can get your mind to go away from the tiny home TV shows that you've watched mm-hmm. of living in a camper, low mm-hmm. ceilings, climbing up this little mm-hmm. ladder to get into your bed, then I give you more of a vision of when was the last time you went to a really cool house and saw an awesome pool house. Take a pool house and just condense that into a livable apartment.
Yeah.
So you go out back and like, that's a really cool pool house with a kitchen and a family room. Just put a bedroom and a bathroom in that. And you've got a similar concept of what these tiny homes can be.
In fact, just before you explained about this little tiny home park, I was thinking that myself. Has anybody done that?
Anywhere? Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, it started to pop up. So when you start sounds like a great idea, right? Yeah, why aren't we doing those? Yeah. If you're familiar with the Airbnb world, a lot of people pop up tiny home communities in remote areas that you can go live in. And whether they're a dome shape in a globe or cool mountain and rustic. There was a company up in the Jackson Hole, Wyoming area? Yeah, the Jackson Hole, Wyoming area that really was a father to the tiny home community years ago. It was a company that is named Will House. It did a really cool project where they owned some land right by the river that went through there. And they were in a battle with the city of saying you can't put homes by it. He wanted to have a really cool rental concept of living right by the river in Jackson in this outdoor community by the Teton Mountains. And so he literally built mobile homes on wheels, but gave them a really cool modern rustic feel that were these 200, 300, 400 square foot cabins and parked them right next to the river and said, according to the city's ordinance, I have to move it once every 6 months. So I just go hook it to the wheels that it's on. I hook up, drag it forward 6 inches, call it good. I go back 6 months later, I push it back 6 inches, call it good. And he did this for years going against city ordinance to say, I own the property. Why can't I build right here?
Yeah.
So he started fathering some of these tiny homes, putting together a community that was an Airbnb community. And they were awesome. We went and stayed in them. And it was like, this is the coolest thing ever. Why can't we do more of this? There is maybe some of that battle of whether it's right to be able to build right on the river. I think we all can agree that some sort of rule and ordinance in place is okay. Yeah, to answer your question, there is more and more communities popping up around. That's in like the vacation traditional market. You look at Southern Utah, yeah. Arizona, you can find these communities around. But even traditionally, let's go back to the concept of apartments, condos, townhomes. I look at how tight we're getting some of the square footages of these places. There was in this last parade of homes when we last talked, there was a condo condo apartment complex that Western Partners or Cowboy Partners did down in downtown Salt Lake. I don't know if you went and saw those. Their one bedroom unit was small. I want to say it was 400 or 500 square feet maybe.
Yeah.
I don't remember exactly, but it was small. That's a tiny home. It's just all stacked into a building.
Yeah.
To get your mind thinking even more, a lot of hotel rooms are actually built in a factory in a tiny home box, and then, literally chucked to a job site, craned up and slid into a steel building. So traditionally, if you just take your hotel room, they can build the entire interior components of your hotel room, put the furniture and everything in it in a factory back in Missouri or wherever. They can build that thing, put it on a truck or a train, ship it out to a site, and then crane it, insert it in, and you're ready to go.
That's crazy.
A hotel room's 350 square feet, 275 square feet.
I don't know about
that. That's not wild,
like
right?
Like those tin box or what?
Yeah,
storage containers.
Exactly.
Keep moving them all
storage
over.
Storage containers is a hobbyist way of playing tiny homes.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Really get your mind opening and thinking away from what on HGTV of someone's living in this tiny low ceiling, fold the bed up to be able to pull the couch down. You know, even though there's some really cool concepts and space saving like that, if you just think of the areas you have lived, whether it's a tight apartment, a hotel room, how they're built, where they're built, you start to then go, I get it. This could be real. I could.
Yeah.
We've all lived in hotel rooms for a week at a time, 2 weeks at a time. Mm-hmm. Cruise ship. How small are those rooms? You live in that for a week plus.
Yeah.
You're perfectly fine as long as you can go out and do stuff.
Out of the ship.
That was so small. This is like blowing my mind though. The hotels are just like.
Here goes
like
our tangent.
That they already have
wait
their
a minute.
Furniture stuff. That's brilliant. People don't have to go up to the third to, I don't know, to move it in. And I just. This is really opening my mind more to, this has been a concept that's been around for a bit.
Yeah, it's really weird when that light turns on, like you just got, and you're like, whoa, wait a minute. I could. This is a cool idea. And then you go back to traditionally of going, but wait, how do we buy land and allow tiny homes that aren't mobile homes? I mean, it's always hard to get your mind away from mobile home communities. Mm-hmm. How do we get rid of that view of a mobile home community and go to a smart designed urban community that allows ownership of less property, smaller home that people are willing to live in? And does that create affordability? And why in the world are we not trying to get there? Because we know people can't continue to afford these price increases. And we know traditionally that we've got this perfect 1,200 to 3,500 square foot home, but it just isn't applicable anymore. It doesn't work for people.
Now, I have a couple of thoughts as I've been listening to you here. One, what's your projection of the future of tiny homes? And two, I guess I could see why traditional neighborhoods wouldn't particularly want tiny homes. I'm trying to think of my neighborhood that everybody's got a quarter of an acre or half an acre.
Right.
And I'm trying to think of every single person put a tiny home in there and the parking and all the logistical and the visual and everything. And I'm thinking, yeah, maybe that's why some of these cities wouldn't be so happy.
Totally. So I mean,
I get that.
Yeah, I hear you. Let me challenge your thought there before I paint a futuristic vision that kind of blows your mind. Okay.
Yeah.
In your current neighborhood, when was the last time you walked to dinner?
When I
to dinner
outside of my own kitchen.
Okay. What about walking to a grocery store?
Yeah.
Or a gym facility? Like in our minds, we all love this idea of suburbia where we have our own yards to take care of and our own yards to play in and our own private streets to drive down. When was the last time you cussed at the HOA because you had to put money into your private street? When was the last time you cussed at the weeds growing in your yard or the overgrown grass that you had to go out and mow in the cold weather? Like I just spent 3 hours last weekend chopping down bushes and prepping my yard for winter. I don't even use the dumb yard anymore. So in a sense, my mind challenging for you is to say, I know that traditionally we're very comfortable with our suburbanization.
Yes.
Open space, yards, 3-car garages that most likely one bay is full of crap. Driveways with RV parking on the side, even if we don't have an RV or a boat or a UTV or a camper, we still have the space. And it's probably filled with a trailer that never gets used. So I'm not really painting this like bad picture of it. I get it. Communities don't want to see this suburban change. Mm-hmm. But right now, a lot of our growth in Utah is saying we need walkable communities that creates less traffic. So if we can go into your community and allow some sort of mixed use development that has grocery shopping, maybe a small market, maybe a gym, maybe a coffee shop, maybe a daycare, and livability above, whether it's City Creek or any type of mixed use community like that, we start to like that. I get a lot of clients that come to me and say, I just want to move to City Creek. That's easy. Everything's right there. I don't need my vehicle. Now get out of Utah and go into high dense communities where we're not driving cars. New York, let's get into Hong Kong. Let's get into like some of these really high dense areas. Singapore, most people don't want a car. It's too expensive. They have other ways to transport themselves around. They walk every day to the grocery store or the market to get fresh food. They walk to dinner. And so like just challenging your world of suburbia is a little bit of saying, forget about me uprooting and saying, I'm going to buy 4 homes around, get 1 acre and put 27 tiny homes into it and think more of a dense community and maybe some of the appeal or the millions of individuals that live in dense communities and make it work. And once you've got your mind there, now let's go into the future of your thought of going, how much longer do we believe cars are physically going to be driving on the road? Do we believe that's a 5-year plan or a 10-year plan? And we all talk about self-driving electric vehicles. We haven't gotten heavy into drone or flying vehicles yet.
We're getting there.
We do know we're getting there, right?
Yeah.
Now I'm going to get into like, okay, Adam, you're crazy. The future's not, it's way further than that. I don't believe so. I think our access to technology and the ability to have like a self-driving vehicle that could just come, I don't even have to own it. I could use Uber or Lyft to say, I want this vehicle to come pick me up and just schedule it every day to take me where I need to go. And it's a self-driving vehicle that I don't have to do anything in. But we get into drones. We already have drones that fly missiles halfway across the world. We have drones that can fly individuals, right? So will our modern day society, our cities, our states, our federal government catch up to technology and allow us to get away from everyday driving vehicles? And maybe that wipes out your garage and the concern of traffic. Suddenly your garage becomes an ADU rental or storage facility. So again, as we start to build this world out, do we think, and this is where I know my mind gets a little crazy with future. This is probably why I started playing in the tiny home market, but I want you to follow me with this. If you think, let's go back 150 years. So what does that put us around 1880? Where were we? Transcontinental Railroad time-ish.
Yeah.
Probably horse right around there. And buggy. Yeah, horse and buggy. Look at where we're at in 150 years. I mean, we're in skyscrapers, self-driving vehicles, printing organs, living longer lives, having modern-day medicine.
The internet.
Yeah, aren't we freaking crazy?
Yeah, it is
crazy. So is it really
a computer?
Is it wild to think that we could go from currently having drones to like private drones that fly us and we get rid of cars in 30 years, 10 years, 20 years? I don't think it's that wild. I really think with our access to information, supercomputers, the computers that we carry around and how quickly that puts information back out there, I don't think it's wild to think that in our lifetime, maybe not yours.
Yeah.
I had to take a stab. But I don't think it's wild in our children's lifetime to be able to see that much inflicted change. And what is the slowdown of all of it right now? I believe the slowdown of it is like our government and community government, our municipalities and cities, and our NIMBYism of residents just saying, I just don't want change. Dang it. I hate change. That's not me. I don't want it. I'm not good at it. Why can't we just have it how it used to be? So,
and just in my own lifetime, look, you guys know who Dick Tracy is?
Yeah. Go back. I mean, I was young, but we go back.
You go Dick Tracy, and he was talking into his wristwatch back when I was a kid. And I mean, that was just like, no way.
Crazy, right?
That is never going to happen, or wireless communication in any way, shape, or form. And I look back at my early days, Star Trek, all these kinds of things. And a lot of times you're talking on the little, you get the little wink, the little phone flip.
Totally.
And start talking. And I'm not like, that's just not ever anything that's real. But yet within 40 years, 50 years, all of it came about.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what you're talking about.
And so that's when you say 40 to 50 years. And when I go back to 150 years, that seems two generations of you know, people's lives ago, which seems so long, but it's really not. So when you really compare, even if you go back 100 years and go into the 30s, that was getting into the World War eras, look at what we've done to change from then to now. Yeah. And whether you're talking technology, medicine, economies and growth, ordinances, government, whatever it is, we have just exponentially grown. So I don't think it's wild to sit here and talk, could your modern day suburbia be challenged?
Yeah.
It already is. Mm-hmm. We talked some projects here in Salt Lake, the Inland Port and what that's doing to Salt Lake. A small community like the Cottonwood Mall and the development going on there. Mm-hmm. I live in the Cottonwood Heights area, and what will happen and is happening at the mouth of Big Cottonwood Canyon at the Gravel Pit, the old Reams that's just east on Fort Union Boulevard, those are mixed use communities. Those are density in an inner suburban development. So neighbors don't like it. There is the NIMBYism that people say, I'm not allowing this in my backyard. But they'll walk to dinner when that restaurant goes in, and they'll walk to the market, and they'll walk to the gym or to the daycare. And we miss that. I miss as a kid riding my bike. So I think I come back and say, when was the last time you walked to dinner?
Yeah.
It's a half mile for me to walk from my house to the end of my little private lane. I never walked to dinner. Never. But I would love it if I could.
Yeah.
I'd challenge that. Yeah. So yeah, I think we're in for change in tiny homes. Whether it's the traditional tiny home that I'm building out of factory, shipping to a site, ever takes reality and takes some sort of grit. If it's just the hobbyists that continue to live in the mobile tiny homes, if it's the ADUs that do become out of a basement apartment or a garage, I do think that is more density influxing into suburban neighborhoods that is helping with the affordability crisis and allowing more people, more density, more population to live in suburban areas. And it's hard for us to see when you see more cars on the road.
It is.
So I get it.
And it's interesting too, because as you're talking and I'm thinking of these houses that people desire to have a 3-car garage, that is a big living space if you turn that into.
Yeah, I mean, traditionally a 3-car garage is probably 600 plus square feet.
Yeah.
That's technically 2 tiny homes. Yeah. If you really split that up, that's a big space.
And then I'm like, all the cement in front. If you don't have a car, you're not going to want to just have.
What's the point of the cement?
So yeah. It does just change things around. Yeah. Just like your older homes, how it was like super high tech to have the speaker system in that you could call to the different
rooms. To call around.
Now people don't care about that.
Those don't really get used. I ever went in a house when they were used.
Yeah, or it was like cool to have a phone in jack in each home. And people don't care about that. They just want to cover it up.
Man, when the wireless phone came out and you actually didn't have a wire. Yeah. I remember like talking to my girlfriend in junior high and I'd have the long wire. Get off the phone, I'm on it. Right? Yell at mom.
Or the dumb waiter. I love that.
Like the dumb waiter.
Put a little food in there and crank it up.
Crank that thing out. Crank that thing down. Just walk up down the bloody stairs. Yes. Yeah, I mean, it is though a challenge. And I've joked a little bit through some development that I've done when I've met with cities, planning commissions, city councils, the public. We've got this intake of soften the blow for development. So if you're going to buy a piece of land and try to rezone and develop it to tighter density, to use some terms, if you're currently at half acres, you might be able to, if you're in a progressive developing area, get that down to quarter acres. Very rare do you see it like double down and get eighth of an acre or smaller than that. Like very rare do you go from more open to really dense. It's really unheard of traditionally for years. It was kind of like, we'll come down one zone tighter, one zone denser. And I think my personal take is that we as a society have caused the problem that has gotten land so expensive by allowing a very slow progression. Because if you really think of the turnover of neighborhoods, it doesn't happen once every 2, 3, 4, 5 years. It happens once every 10 to 30 years. Mm-hmm. So if you're allowing that to turn over and allowing that to get more dense, we've now accelerated the problem. So now because we have this mass inflation, our affordability has become so unattainable for so many people, land has gotten so expensive, homes have gotten so expensive, we almost have to like speed that up. And no one likes hearing that, but we have to allow a half acre density in the right areas. It's really about smart planning. We have to allow that to go straight into mixed use community with apartments or condos, like, or townhome, rows of townhomes in townhome type projects. Like, we have to find a way to increase that density exponentially. But then it comes into like smart development, smart growth, right?
Yeah, that's why we're here on the podcast, right, Stephanie? To learn from Adam.
Sorry, I'm pulling away from some tiny homes, but it is. I think my big point of all that is you turn on this light and you're like, oh, wait, tiny homes, get away from traditional. I got this tiny home. And what does that look like? That can be a really cool hobby and it's really fun. But they also have to really kind of have that light turn on for the big picture to go, I get the point. Now I understand it. And then let's dive into how you can build a tiny home. If I can do it with a roof over my head in a controlled environment, I can work 365 days out of the year, so to speak, and take out our holidays. And I can work people from a typical 9-to-5 job and not worry about commuting, cost of gas, a vehicle breaks down, there's snow in the way. I can put people in a factory, condition the environment, and work and build a home in a conditioned environment that doesn't have to deal with sun, water, snow, rain throughout the rest of the year. So now I can create some better efficiencies, create, in a lot of ways, a better built product because it was in a controlled environment and ship it out to a site. That's really cool. So to open up a little bit more of a discussion about that.
You ever thought about running for governor?
No.
I have a question though with the shipping.
I don't like politics enough.
Okay, so with the shipping though, that's probably pretty expensive.
It can be right now. So right now, I don't believe that technically a tiny home, if we're talking a tiny home, it may be different for a hotel room, but I don't believe a tiny home is allowed to be put on a train cart and shipped via train, which sounds crazy that we're talking trains when we're not talking like technology. Mm-hmm. We're going back to trains, but that's probably the cheapest way to transport these things because they're not a whole lot different than a shipping container. Yeah. So if you could work those specs, I believe and there's a lot of legislation to try to get them approved to there. Mm-hmm. But right now they are traditionally put on a semi and driven down the road. Can be expensive because as you can get up to, it's 11'9" is your maxed width. And then your length of trailer could be up to 65 feet long. So that's the largest size of unit I could put on and traditionally go down a single lane of traffic. So any highway, freeway, I could drive that down a single lane. Once I get wider than that, I'm now guided with double lane traffic, oversized load. It can get expensive. To put a dollar figure on that, if we're shipping something from southern Utah to northern Utah, and let's say we were going into a remote area from, let's say, St. George to Bear Lake, that would probably be about a $3,500 to $4,500 shipping bill. And then I'm going to get a crane to move it off. So normally we'd charge about $5,000 to relocate that and crane it onto site.
Oh, that's actually not as bad.
So not as wild as you think.
Yeah.
Right? Not too wild.
Yeah.
We're not hiring a helicopter to bring this thing into place. We try really hard to crane it in. Yeah, not as wild as you would think, but there's still, I mean, that's a large cost when you're talking a cost per square foot basis of 360 square feet now costing you $100,000, $120,000, $150,000. At some point you go, okay, at what point does it switch to say, just build me 1,500 square feet? And that's where I weigh the difference of, is it a hobby type job and something fun? Or do I believe in the big light of what are we doing for affordability? And that's really where the side gig for me of tiny homes has struggled, is trying to get, number one, people to turn on the light and understand what that goal or mission is. And number two, how do you take it to the scales of economy to the point to where it is making a big difference? And I don't believe we've figured that out yet, but there's a lot of resource and money and equity that goes into trying to figure that out right now. Not just for me, but from all over the country.
So there is a future, you think, for tiny
homes? Oh, absolutely. If you expand into the market, not just on a national basis, but on a worldly basis, there's a lot of different areas, China specifically, that is doing this and effectively doing this. But going back to like logistics, you get inner city and try to figure out how to build downtown New York. People show up with big trucks and trailers. Where in the world do they park and how do they build? Mm-hmm. If you can build offsite and bring that in, if you can get that grit, there's something huge to it. Canada 2 years ago released, and I don't know what specific area of Canada, but a certain area of Canada released the ability to sell and infill the alleyways between buildings. So they were allowing people to come in and build offsite ADUs or tiny homes.
In the alleys?
Yeah. And then crane those up and bolt them to existing buildings in between the alleys.
Wow.
And sell that space to allow more density.
Really?
Yeah. So that's again, talking some crazy concepts
That's interesting.
Right now, they're just used for garbage collection and what we see in TV shows, crime fighting.
Shooting policemen, drug dealers.
So why not get rid of that space?
I love it.
But yeah, so I think there is a big grit to it and it's growing more and more. You just don't hear a lot about it because it is future, man. It's change in ordinances, change the way people think. And the minute you bring up tiny home communities, people go to mobile homes, modern day mobile homes. Mm-hmm. So you really have to challenge the way you think about it.
I've had my eyes opened here.
There you go.
And listening to all this. And an old dog can learn new tricks.
Oh, and that must be time's up, man.
No, this has been interesting. It's been very informative.
It's a very fun subject. Earlier, before we started recording, or I think maybe we weren't recording or were recording, but we talked about my base of business is custom homes and suburban environments. So I am very used to dealing with half acre size lots that we're building a 6, 7, 8, 9, 10,000 square foot home. We're putting wild amenities into it, whether it's an indoor pickleball court or an indoor basketball court or pools. Like, so that is the majority of my day to day. So it really is interesting to me when I go from that to mixed use communities and talking tiny homes. And I've tried to draw the correlation of what is my appeal to that. And I really think it is just the effect that we see day to day on our economy and our community and what we're doing and how we're doing it to better it for our kids and the generations below us. And even though I excel at building custom homes for clients, I don't think that's the long-term best growth for our economy. It may be the best growth for the individual right now, but it's not how our economy survives. So it's fun to me to really get into it and just talk future and say, what is my part in it? I don't know what my part is in it, but I think every little bit that we can all do to challenge ourselves and grow with the communities around us is really good. We're not going to stop growth in Salt Lake City, Utah. That's one thing we all know, right? I mean, with the Olympics coming back, do you really think we're like, no more building. I don't want any more density. I don't want anybody else at my ski resorts. Say the heck off my trails. You think that's doing us any good? Stop that gondola. Don't widen Wasatch. Like, okay, then what? What is the fix to that? So pro or against, like, what is the fix to the growth we're going to have no matter what? And what part are we all doing? And I don't know, maybe it's thinking into the future.
But I can see what's happened with talking about suburbia is that if you go back to the 1920s, 1930s, it was all about the city.
Yep.
Everybody wanted to be in the city.
Yep.
And then the automobile came about, which really moved everything.
Out of the city.
So so now it was like we can get to the city.
But then we turned back into being the inner city.
Yeah. And so we're in the suburbia. Uh-huh. And then the cities got flooded with, I don't want to say less desirable. I just want to say lower income. It became less taken care of.
More crime.
Yeah, more crime. Issues, so everything happened there. It was like, that's where everybody lived. Then the automobile came. It completely 100% changed the way everything pushed back out. Now everybody's way out, but everybody doesn't want to be out. They're also finding it's isolated.
Totally.
And then going back into work, traffic has gotten worse and it's become a big nightmare. Now people are starting to see this, I guess you can
see.
A desire to go right back into the cities.
Urban environments, yeah.
So the real question to me is, are the cities going to prepare themselves to receive that kind of attention?
In other words,
you don't want to go back into the, you don't want to go into New York City right now because it's crime. So if you want the people to come back into the city and make it what it was, and now you've got everything
in there.
It's got to be able to rebuild those cities in that way. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, totally. And I actually will give Mayor Mendenhall props for, they've been very progressive about building downtown Salt Lake City. Look at the growth we're having down there and allowing what they're doing down there and trying to work with the transients and the crime. Like, we are very progressive in that right now. I read a book recently called A Country of Cities that challenges that kind of very thought that says that suburbia was pushed by our government to connect cities on developers' dimes or individuals' dimes. The idea was, let's get people out and build. Tell them that the American dream is owning more land, having your space, getting away from the riffraff, and that downtown cities are more crime-ridden, lower-income people. And that allows us to then get rid of the Transcontinental Railroad and connect roads into cities all over the world, which we've done, all on developers' dimes. My dime, your dime.
That's correct.
And so it challenges that, but then it starts to say, we are happier as an individual. And this is what got me started on like challenging my mind. We're happy as an individual living in a community that we don't have to drive back and forth and spend hours in our car. We don't have to mow our lawns and spend the entire weekend taking care of the property that we live on. And so my challenge in my mind was kind of like, I'm a suburbanite, man. I've got my boat and I've got my extra vehicle and I've got my extra garage and I've got my all my space and I love my privateness. But part of me is like, yeah, but do I really? There is an appeal to just put on my headphones and walk to the grocery store.
One of the things that I've found is we've gotten older. My wife and I, see, we've got all the kids out of the house. The house used to be a hustle bustle.
Yeah.
Now, sometimes when I come home to my wife, she says, this is a lonely place.
Yeah.
I've got all this acreage around me. I got all these houses. I don't see anybody.
Right.
I got a railroad that runs by in the distance that I see, and that gives you life.
Right.
When you live in the city, you live. There is life.
Right.
In the
Did
city.
You know it's statistically proven that in retirement homes, they're more happy on a busier road because they want to sit there and watch traffic go by.
Yes,
they don't
yes.
want the quiet, peaceful horse just sitting in there. The butterfly. They think they do, but then they want to be able to just watch the busyness. So there's something to be said for that, right?
The peacefulness is nice to have, but it's only a place to visit. A place to live is in with other people.
Yeah.
I mean, all of us, our natural desire is to connect.
Yeah.
And when we don't connect with other people, we die.
Yeah. Yeah, so this book does challenge a lot of economy is better when we can put more people in one environment. The infrastructure is less expensive. The taxes are less expensive. The cost of living for everybody is less expensive. It's a more walkable community.
Yeah,
we're not having issues with snow and water. I don't know. You just go into all these different issues. It challenges it to say, do I really care if it got more dense in my neighborhood if the amenities came? And that's where I come back as a developer and say, I'm in Cottonwood Heights. I'm pro widen Wasatch, pro put the gondola up. Because it's coming anyways.
Yeah.
And I believe those amenities help me with access to my ski resorts, restaurants that I can eat at, local markets I can shop at. So if I don't like it, then I need to move.
And it's just a community.
So before we end, I want to put a plug in for your podcast so that people can continue to listen to you. So tell us about your podcast.
So we started, I would say about 6 months ago, we started the Breen Homes podcast. And the initial goal on it was all things construction. Like, what can we talk about? And it, what that concept was saying is we don't know what we want to talk about. So let's just call it all things construction. Mm-hmm. And it really has started to focus in on specific topics that we find interesting, whether it is tiny homes or the goal of professional networking or social media or what you should ask your contractor before you hire them to build or what does it look like living with a contractor? And we invite guests on. We've just had this fun flow with it. And I've learned that the thing I love about podcasts is it just gets to know that person or that personality. And so I find it fun to just sit and talk, and then be able to go back and listen to what that was and get some interest built behind it, and to learn more about me or small business or construction or growth in our economy, what our life is like out here in Salt Lake City, Utah. I talk a lot about just that. And the thing I really love more than anything is it's just an unfiltered, open discussion. Mm-hmm. And it's fun to be able to just sit behind a microphone and have a conversation like this, like we would around the dinner table. Mm-hmm. Maybe not Thanksgiving, because that's reserved for politics and religion.
And football.
Yes, yes, exactly. And if you can mix all three up and start a huge family fight, awesome. I think I saw a shirt the other day that said, Thanksgiving, I'm here to talk politics and religion. And I was like, I need that. That's awesome. It becomes this unfiltered dinner conversation, and that's fun. I mean, that's... we've gotten so far away from that with technology mm-hmm. and just looking at our phones that why not sit here and have a fun conversation about it and then challenge it. I would love anybody that comes on and is like, I totally disagree with him. I'm sending an email or a text or whatever. Disagree, that's fun. That brings up good viewpoints. But yeah, I mean, I'd love to have people chime into the Breen Homes podcast. It's on Spotify and Apple, and learn a little bit more about me and challenge me, man. Put comments on there. Come on the show. Let's have fun. I always say, you know, let's throw the gloves out and have a good discussion.
So go troll Adam.
Come troll me.
Just a plug for all you homeowners out there. Remember, you get to choose your title company.
And here at Title One, there's a reason why there's a one in our title. Learn all about our colossal closings
by going to askusutah.com.
We celebrate with you in securing a house for your home.